From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. 50 years ago today, the Supreme Court handed down its second ruling in the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case. The court said public schools must integrate with all deliberate speed. Back then, the civil rights activists argued the ruling weakened the intent of the first, which struck down legal segregation in schools. In fact, it was more than 10 years before schools allowed blacks and whites to be in the same classroom. Did Brown, too, accomplish the high court's ruling, and are public schools today being shaped once again by segregation? Abigail Thurmstrom is senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York and author of No Excuses, Closing the Racial Gap in Learning. And Orlando Patterson is professor of sociology at Harvard University and author of The Ordeal of Integration, Progress, and Resentment in America's Racial Crisis. We thank you both for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
By the way, I'm co-author of No Excuses. I don't want to leave out the fact that I wrote it with my husband, Stephen Thurmstrom.
Okay. Yes, Abigail, we want happiness at home, so thank you very much for that. Let me ask you both this, and Abigail, I'll start with you. The idea of separate but equal, many people say today we are still seeing segregated schools across this country, albeit not legally by law, but by virtue of blacks and whites still seeing a tremendous gap. Do you believe that to be the case?
Well, I think you're talking about two different things there. One is the racial gap in academic achievement. I assume that's what you referred to when you talked about the gap. But the other is the racial composition of schools. And the average black child today attends a school that's 54% black, 31% white, 11% Hispanic, 3% Asian. That's hardly, you know, segregation by our old definition. Indeed, I have great hesitation about using today the word segregation, which is so loaded. It really should refer to the de jure segregation that Brown versus Board brought an end to, although much too slowly. Of course, 10 years after Brown in the Deep South, there was no racial mixing in classrooms, but the days of segregation are really over, and we do have, as I said, racially identifiable schools. But you know, if the average black child today attends a school that's 54% black, one that's hardly overwhelmingly black, and it means that half the black children attend schools that are less than half black, and in addition, we do not have any evidence that racially mixed schools, let's say schools down, which is not demographically possible given the distribution of racial and ethnic groups in the society, schools that reflect the fact that blacks are 13% of the American population of schools, that we would have that we would close the racial gap in learning. That is the primary problem. There's just zero evidence for that. There's no reason to think that a black child sitting in an overwhelmingly black classroom cannot learn, provided you are offering quality education.
That being said, and that's the rub, Professor, the idea of whether or not quality education is being provided. Many people are suggesting that perhaps in the 50s it shouldn't have been so much about separate and equal, but equal.
Look, I think I agree with Abigail that the term segregation in the first half of the 20th century means something quite different from what it means today. I want to emphasize that. Then we're talking about Jim Crow, a vicious system, American version of Nazism, which was vile and which sort of defined another group as inferior, not fit to sit with your own kids. And that had to go. Today, we're referring to basically a statistical, demographic, and economic situation in which the question is that blacks are attending schools which are, for a substantial number of blacks, it's they're primarily with other blacks. Or to be more specific, there was tremendous desegregation as a result of the Brown versus Board of Education right up to the 80s. And what has alarmed many people is the fact that there has been resegregation of the very schools and very school districts which experienced tremendous desegregation, and that the courts have seemed to turn their backs on the principle of integration, and even in some cases, such as Charlotte, where the community itself wanted to maintain a more integrated school, the courts have actually ordered the school districts to in effect, resegregate. Now, I think there are several things to note. I don't think we can speak of America as a single unit here. As Abigail pointed out, there are certain parts of America where integration, certainly for whites, is impossible. North Dakota, which is over 90% white, you're not going to have a high exposure of whites to blacks. They're only a sprinkling, if any, of them. I don't know any black who ever lived in North Dakota. Similarly, in certain sort of counties in the South, where, which are heavily black or Latino, it's hard to imagine getting integration. So, I mean, I think what one has to emphasize is that in certain areas, in the South and in the North, which had achieved what looked like increasing integration, there has been a substantial resegregation. That's just a fact. Now, the point is...
Let me stop you there for just a moment, Professor, and ask Ms. Thernstrom, with that being said, there are many people who clearly believed that as of today, the school system, the public school system, would have looked vastly different and been given a better opportunity, particularly for those African-American and minority students who come from poverty-ridden communities. In that instance, can we say that the ideal of Brown v. Board and Brown v. Board 2 has failed?
Well, I don't think so at all. I mean, Brown versus Board was about de jure segregation. Now, it had one sentence that talked about equal educational opportunity, but in the context, it really referred to de jure, to doors open for black children. I have to say, I don't buy into this notion of resegregation at all. We have got...
Even if it's de facto.
Even if it's de facto. That is, we have now schools that reflect the demographic reality of the demographic reality of America. That is, look, if you take our largest cities and... Black children are mostly in urban schools. We're down to only in Chicago and Los Angeles, only 10% of the students are white. In Detroit, only 4% are white. In New York City, only 15% are white. I mean, white enrollment in 25 out of 26 of America's largest urban school districts, and Salt Lake City is the exception, but in 25 out of 26 of America's largest urban school districts, we're down to white enrollment of an average of 17%. The schools reflect that demographic reality. And, of course, there's been huge demographic change with the flood of Hispanics into urban areas. I mean, you can't create majority white schools.
Professor, that speaks to the separate part. It does not speak to the equal part.
Yeah.
Well, these schools are not educating children well, but that is a problem that is that has to do with the whole structure of public education in this country. Mm-hmm. We know how to educate kids. Good schools across this country are educating the most highly disadvantaged
children. Can I get the word in?
Yes, Professor, please, go ahead.
With respect to what Abigail just said, I mean, what is being reflected, and it's a term which is missing from the conversation so far, is class inequality. I mean, look, New York, it's ridiculous. It's absurd to think of it. I mean, New York is a predominantly white city. And one would expect that its school population would be predominantly white. Same goes for Boston. It's not. And what's reflected here is, of course, the fact that America has become, especially urban America, a very unequal society, and the schools reflect this inequality. Upper middle class and middle class parents are moving their kids out of the public schools into private schools and or going to the suburbs where blacks are free to go to but cannot afford to go, or most blacks. Blacks who can afford it go to highly integrated school, or can go to whatever schools they want. So we're talking about a society which in which blacks remain disproportionately poor, and their poverty is reflected, and the same goes for Latinas, in the fact that they go to schools with other poor kids. Now, what is the important point here is what the implication of this. Does this? There are two things to note about the attempt at integration. One is its presumed educational sort of benefits. The other is its social benefit. That is, it's assumed that having an integrated education for blacks will close the gap in
Professor, with about a minute left.
That has not worked, except in a few cases. The social benefits are substantial, however. That is, say, blacks and whites sort of living together as students do have benefits later on, especially for blacks. I mean, even when blacks do not improve in their educational skills, it's shown that blacks who went to integrated school do actually much better later on in life. I do think that, however, that the fundamental problem here is class inequality. And the question, of course, is the degree to which we can upgrade the amount of funds which are in black schools. However,
so, Professor, it seems I've got to stop you there, Professor, because I'm up against the clock. But it seems what we're looking at here is the idea that class has, to some degree in this country, superseded race. Abigail Thernstrom, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and Orlando Patterson, a professor of sociology at Harvard University. I thank you both for joining us. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.